As America hit bottom in the Great Depression, two desperate alcoholics did something their wives worried might never happen. They gave up drinking. It was a personal triumph for these broken men, and shortly after meeting in 1935, they founded Alcoholics Anonymous.
AA is really, you know, the font of most self-help groups around the country now. I mean, and it's not just for alcohol or even not just for addictions, but there's many, many other groups concerned with everything from being overweight to coping with cancer to coping with depression.
Using this time-tested model, people come together who share an experience and learn from each other how to cope. It has helped literally millions of people. I'm David Freudberg. Stay with us for Steps to Recovery, the History of AA on Humankind. This Humankind special, Steps to Recovery, the History of AA, is produced in association with GBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund, whose contributors include the Henry Luce Foundation.
Other people think you're doing it, but it doesn't feel to the alcoholic like you're doing it. It feels like it's being done to you. You know, it feels like you, the one that you are, is trying to stop this, but you can't. It's hard for anybody that has never had that to know what it's like.
How the special bond of fellow sufferers gave birth to the worldwide recovery movement of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. From his earliest drinking experiences as a young soldier at a party during World War I, Bill Wilson of East Dorset, Vermont, recalled getting thoroughly drunk. The next time or two, he passed out completely. Thus began his ride on the wild horse of alcoholism. He pledged to his increasingly anxious wife, Lois, and to himself that he would quit, yet over and over, Bill would drink again. The downward spiral of these repeated relapses endangered his health, wrecked his finances, shattered his self-confidence, and drove him to the edge of bewilderment. But Bill Wilson eventually discovered a formula for addiction recovery that would truly change the world.
Now, people had known for centuries that once an alcoholic, what they called an alcoholic, started drinking, he couldn't stop. Wilson's brilliant insight, in my opinion, was that's not the problem for an alcoholic, stopping once they start. The problem for an alcoholic is, why do you pick up a drink when you got no booze in your body? Why do you pick up the first drink? It doesn't make any sense.
That's Bill S. of Fairfield, Connecticut. He uses only his initial when speaking publicly about Alcoholics Anonymous in accordance with AA's tradition of anonymity. Bill is a dealer in rare books and an author. He's maintained continuous sobriety for over 30 years and has pondered the mystery of alcoholic denial.
Every time you pick up a drink, you get fired, your wife throws you out of the house, you have car accidents, you hurt yourself. There's nothing but problems. You know it. You've sworn on Bibles, I'm never going to drink again. Why, when you got no booze in your body, do you pick up the first drink? Wilson was very clear that we have these alcoholics have these blank mental spots where no matter what happened before, no matter what we said, no matter what we promised, we pick up a drink. And once we pick up the first drink, then we're dead.
Now, when you're an active alcoholic, you're on the wrong train, going down the wrong track, in the wrong direction, making all the wrong stops. And to wrench your life over to a life of sobriety and get on the right track, going in the right direction, making all the right sober stops, is a very difficult thing to do.
Alcoholics are up against the formidable foe of addiction. It's described in AA literature as cunning, baffling, and powerful. And this exasperating pattern rarely yields to simple willpower. Until the mid-1930s, drunkards were widely written off as incurable and tragic. But Alcoholics Anonymous was born. Tens of millions of people in utter despair have since found relief. Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry at Stanford University, has studied why AA works.
Well, it has a lot of the things in it that we know changes human behavior. You know, a group who supports and models change. I mean, anybody who's had to join a running group to get the motivation to exercise, understands the effect that social support has when we want to improve our behavior. It has modeling. And you can go in and see people who have been sober 5, 10, 20 years and see the things they're doing and go, hey, you know, I'd like to be like that. You know, how is that person pulling that off? How do I do that? And it instills hope. People come in a very bad situation, and then they see other people say, you know what, I was in a bad situation, and now I'm doing well. And hope is a very important part of change. I mean, if we don't believe things can get better, we're not going to try to put in the effort.
In addition to offering hope, AA has formulated specific tools and time-tested practices for maintaining a sober life. These are famously distilled into a short list known as the 12 Steps. And Alcoholics Anonymous is broadly accessible. It's free, it's open to all, and AA groups, now numbering about 65,000 in the United States and Canada, are found in practically every community.
AA is really, you know, the font of most self-help groups around the country now. I mean, and it's not just for alcohol or even not just for addictions, but there's many, many other groups concerned with everything from being overweight to coping with cancer to coping with depression that, you know, use a model where you bring people together who share an experience and therefore feel a sense of intimacy and trust, and you learn from each other how to cope with the situation you're in.
An alcoholic named Ralph B. authored some of the Alcoholics Anonymous literature. He and others I've spoken with knew AA founder Bill Wilson, who died in 1971.
He was a fascinating person. He had a Lincoln-esque appearance. He looked, to my mind, homely enough to be a great man. You know, to a great extent, I think, played on it too. Tall, lanky, door-looking, who could flash a wonderful smile or could look like a drowned sheepdog.
He was dynamic. He was a salesman all of his life in the brokerage business. He'd sell you your own gold watch. We used to meet occasionally in New York in the Plaza Hotel, Oak Room Bar there. He used to drink ginger ale and settle the affairs of state.
Bill was a very comfortable person to be around. You wanted to confide in Bill because he was so comfortable. You could talk almost anything with Bill. I carried all my troubles to him. He was like my father or brother.
Nell Wing, not herself an AA member, served as Bill Wilson's longtime secretary at the headquarters in New York.
He had suffered so much, and the depressions. He was always talking to people about how to reach a level of serenity that they could not find. And so many members are subject to depressions themselves. Bill could share that at a fantastic level.
Bill Wilson's tormented journey was dramatized in the 1989 film My Name is Bill W. Academy Award nominee James Woods portrayed the title character.
I feel cheated, angry, always so full of fear. So I drink more, and it makes it okay for a while. I convince myself that things will turn around tomorrow, soon, that I'll make it all up for you, but it only gets worse. I keep promising you, others, myself, that's it, no more. Going on the wagon, that's it. And I think I mean it, but the guilt and the depression, I can't look in a mirror.
William Griffith Wilson had a troubled childhood. His father deserted the family when Bill was 10 years old. His mother shortly left for Boston, leaving Bill and his sister in Vermont in the care of their grandparents. At age 22, he married Lois Burnham, a physician's daughter from New York, where he would find work on Wall Street. Till the end of his remarkable life, she maintained heroic devotion to Bill, despite many agonizing trials. She died in 1988. In the 2010 film When Love Is Not Enough, Winona Ryder depicted the story of Lois Wilson, who would go on to form Al-Anon, a support group for loved ones of alcoholics. Here, Bill lies in a hospital bed, trembling after a binge.
Bill, can you hear me? Bill, I thought your love for me would make you stop. But if you can't stop for us, then stop because you'll die if you don't. I will fight for you with everything I have. I will fight for you, but I need you to help me. I need you to fight with me. We have to do this together, honey. I'm right here, Bill. I'm right here.
Bill Wilson's frightful descent into addiction would continue even as the consequences of his drinking grew worse. His doctor, William Silkworth, who treated many thousands of drunks, warned of possible brain damage and declared Bill's case to be hopeless. And privately, he informed Lois of her grim choices: have Bill committed, watch him go crazy, or simply let him die. But a new development would introduce a hint of light in the bleakly dark tunnel. Bill's longtime friend and drinking buddy Ebby Thatcher turned up at one point, and to everyone's astonishment, Ebby was now sober. He had joined the Oxford Group, a Christian-based organization popular in the 1930s. Some of its principles of rigorous self-examination, confessing one's misconduct, and making restitution were later adapted to the 12 steps. Ebby had a friend named Roland Hazard, also an alcoholic, who sought treatment by the world-famous psychiatrist Carl Jung. Bill S.
Roland Hazard went to Switzerland to try and solve his alcohol problem. And he worked with Dr. Jung for a considerable period of time, felt that he was sober. He left and promptly got drunk again. And Jung famously said to him, listen, you're an alcoholic of such a type that I just can't help you. There's nothing I can do for you. Nobody can help you. Now, once in a while, I've seen and I've heard of people who have had this huge psychic change. Jung said the only people I've seen who have been able to get sober and stay sober are people who have gone through this tremendous change. And Hazard supposedly said, well, that's great. He was an Episcopalian. He goes to church. He said, I've got a great religious practice. And Jung says that, well, that's a little naive, because clearly the religious practice that you've been doing over the last several years has not been able to keep you sober. You need a vital religious experience that is going to keep you sober. So you need to go back and take your game up on a spiritual level and find a power greater than yourself that will, in fact, allow you to stay sober and not drink again. And Hazard did that, took that advice, and that advice got passed from Dr. Jung to Hazard to Ebby Thatcher to Bill Wilson.
That message from Dr. Carl Jung, a towering figure of 20th century wisdom, apparently was taken to heart by Bill Wilson. In late 1934, at age 39, he lay in desolation at Towns Hospital in New York. Ralph B.
Bill at his highest was in front of an audience telling his story and making it seem the most natural thing in the world that he had a spiritual experience that he accepted in a modest way.
I was, in fact, a child crying in the dark. And I said, as you have said, now I will do anything to get well. Anything to get well. God knows this is more serious than cancer. And indeed, I have a cancer of the mind, of the emotions, and of the soul. Yes, I will do anything to get well. And then, with no hope, no faith at all, I cried out, if there is a God, Will he show himself? My experience was granted to me very suddenly. It seemed to me that place lit up in a great white light. In the mind's eye, I seem to be on a mountaintop. A great wind is blowing, and I know it is not of air, but of spirit. A sense of presence is around and through me. And I say to myself, thank God that I'm a free man.
Exploring the remarkable history of Alcoholics Anonymous. From its founding in 1935, AA developed into a worldwide support group that has helped tens of millions recover from the ravages of alcoholism. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. To learn more about the 12 steps of AA, and to obtain an audio download or CD of this documentary, Steps to Recovery, The History of AA, please visit humanmedia.org. Bill Wilson's physician had explained that alcoholism is not just a vice or a habit. This is compulsion, he said. This is pathological craving. This is disease. Yet somehow, after Wilson's dramatic flash of inspiration in his hospital room that December day in 1934, he would never drink again. But Alcoholics Anonymous marks its beginning as the following June, after Wilson met the man who was to become the co-founder of AA, Robert Smith.
Well, they were both professional men.
Historian Bill S.
Bill Wilson is frequently called a stockbroker. He wasn't really a stockbroker. He was an entrepreneurial stock analyst. Bill was very, very, very successful with that. He was a very sophisticated analyst and a very sophisticated investor. Bob Smith, on the other hand, was a doctor. He was a proctologist. He'd been in Akron for a number of years, although his drinking had seriously impacted his practice, as it had, of course, Bill Wilson's reputation on Wall Street. He had become a lone wolf down there. People didn't want to talk to him at all by the time we got into the mid-30s. Both of them were what some people might call raging alcoholics at the time, getting in a tremendous amount of trouble.
And both had consulted physicians and explored some kind of a spiritual solution. But addiction is a perfect storm of physical craving, emotional disturbance, and soul sickness. And while professionals had certainly tried, and Bill Wilson was in a fragile remission, neither man by that point had found a lasting way out of the addictive trap.
One of the key discoveries, if you will, of Bill Wilson and the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous was that the message of recovery, which had always been delivered by professionals or non-alcoholics, typically with little success, could be done with a much higher degree of success by one drunk talking to another drunk. Wilson's famous first encounter with Dr. Bob Smith, for instance, was a conversation that he claimed all he did was tell Bob Smith his story, his drinking problems, his drinking escapades, the low point to which he got over and over and over again, the resolutions he made, and the lack of success he had with getting sober until he stumbled on this formulation that worked for him.
The historic first encounter of these two personalities occurred in May 1935, at a point when Bill had managed to maintain a tentative sobriety of a few months. He had traveled from New York to Akron, Ohio on a business mission to join a proxy fight involving a local rubber machinery company.
When he got out there, it was clear they were going to lose that fight. And at one point in his disappointment, Wilson found himself pacing the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio. And at one end of the lobby, famously was a bar where he could hear the tinkling of glasses and the laughter of drinkers. And at the other end was a phone booth, next to which was a list of churches and the Sunday services. And he paced back and forth, realizing how severely tempted he was to go in and drink and throw away 5 months of sobriety, which he had at that point. He also realized that what had kept him sober for those 5 months in New York, despite the fact that he had gotten nobody sober in New York during that time frame, was that he had worked hard with other people, that he had gone out and tried to find other people that he could talk to and to help. He was trying to help.
By telephone, Bill Wilson reached an Akron clergyman who put him in touch with a woman active in the local chapter of the Oxford Group, the same organization that Bill's drinking buddy Ebby Thatcher found helpful. On Bill Wilson's behalf, she telephoned the home of Dr. Bob Smith, a personal friend whose severe drinking problem distressed her deeply. Unfortunately, Dr. Bob at that moment was passed out under the dining room table. But she arranged for Bill to meet Bob at her home the following day. The beleaguered doctor greeted him warily. Their awkward first conversation is reconstructed in the stage play Bill W. and Dr. Bob.
In that hotel lobby, I knew in my guts, like a man knows he's gonna die, that to stay out of that bar, I needed help. I tried praying, it didn't work. And then I realized that what I needed was another drunk to talk to, just as much as he needed me. Friend, I need your help.
Well, how can I help?
I think you just have.
If I don't drink, I'm a monster.
I need it. Boosh, it's the glue holding me together. The monster is our disease. Oh, God.
That initial exchange gradually deepened into a bond of genuine respect and affection. Bill Wilson soon took up temporary lodging at the home of Dr. Bob and his wife Anne, who welcomed the visitor as a ray of hope. Then at a medical convention the next month, Bob slipped again briefly, but it would be his final relapse. Once back on the wagon, he and Bill approached a hospital patient, a lawyer they would call Bill D. A nurse wondered if he might become AA number 3. At first cautious, the lawyer decided to take them up, a preliminary indication that AA might have legs.
They discover, first off, that they can understand each other in a way they've never been able to understand other people, and second, that helping each other help themselves.
Keith Humphreys of Stanford.
So it was, you know, having someone to support me matters, but also my ability to say, I get you. You know, I'm an alcoholic as well. I understand you. Funnily enough, that helping of other people helped oneself. And that became central to AA's entire philosophy of how recovery works.
It really was kind of an epiphany by Bill Wilson to realize that only by reaching out to another alcoholic could he safeguard his own sobriety.
Yeah, it's a radical insight, really. I mean, if you think about how mental health services works in general, if you go in as a patient, the expectation is I'm going to be the focus and, you know, the designated helper is going to help me. And it's, you know, a fundamental rethinking to say, you know what, I'm going to be a helper and a helpee at the same time. And as it turns out, psychological research done over the years validates that insight, because if we look at the literature on social support, you get some benefit from being given social support, but the evidence is even stronger that you get benefit from giving social support. That seems to be good for our health to help other people.
The dance of mutual support occurs on a level playing field in AA. Since all members have battled addiction, no one can pull rank on anyone else. In a sense, all alcoholics are equal experts. The dynamics of helping each other rely on people's openness, revealing one's own experience with honesty and humility, and listening to others with compassion.
Well, the beauty of sharing your story is you've gone from the abstract to the particular. You're talking about what happened to me. This is who I am. I'm the kind of guy who lost a job. I'm the kind of guy who had a near-fatal car accident. I was a guy who swore off, and I actually swore off for a month. But when I came back and started drinking again after a month, it was worse than it was before. All of those things are intimate. They're personal. They're believable because they're coming from that kind of a source. It's a practical approach. It's a story about what happened to me and how bad I was and how good I got it today because of what I've done with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Coming up in a minute on the second half of Humankind, part two of our history of Alcoholics Anonymous, we consider the science behind AA's effectiveness and listen to personal stories of how alcoholics work the steps of recovery. When Humankind continues in a moment.